You're listening to the Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 43 is, are there any decent arguments for the existence of God? And we read The Miracle of Theism by J.L. Mackey from 1983, chapters 1 to 3, 5 to 6, maybe 8, maybe 11, which is a guide to and critical appraisal of the traditional arguments for and against the existence of God. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer, existing in the necessarily perfect city of Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Seth Paskin, meteorologically consolidating myself in Austin, Texas.
This is Wes Allman in Boston, Massachusetts.
And this is Robert Scott, without a rational framework, coming from Cape Town, South Africa.
Welcome, Robert.
Yes, welcome.
Yep.
And welcome back, Wes and Seth, both on recording for the first time in a little while.
Yeah.
3 or 4 months, I think, right?
Well, we are geeked to be doing this. We've built up to this for a long time, or more precisely, we have been building up to the new atheism episode, which is next one, that had been very often requested. And we decided that we needed to do something more respectable to get more of the actual philosophy out there before we move to what I consider a more social and political debate. The new atheists are certainly not making new arguments, but the stance they are taking is more a matter of trying to marginalize the political influence of religion rather than doing anything remotely philosophical. We'll go into that more next time. We actually had been planning an episode from the very beginning for let's read a little Aquinas, let's read St. Anselm, a little Descartes, and that always seemed like that just would take us about 2 minutes to read those things out loud. I mean, that's like a total of 10 pages. But this J.L. Mackey book was very often recommended. I had seen it mentioned in the Dan Dennett book that we'll be reading for the New Atheism episode mentioned, and I think actually this is part of Dennett's excuse for not giving any serious treatment to the formal arguments against the existence of God, because he thought, it's already been done. This is the definitive work. But then I also saw in, I mentioned on the Schleiermacher episode, a book by Eric Reitan, I believe, called Is God a Delusion? So it's a response to the New Atheists. And he too, a theist, says, yeah, this is the book. So this is a guy, I don't think his biography matters too much. He's at one of the big universities in England. He died around the same time this book came out. He was responding to another big-time English philosopher at Oxford or Cambridge or one of those named Richard Swinburne. So there's a lot of references to Richard Swinburne. And I think overall, though he tries to be exhaustive through all these arguments, it's a natural theology approach. I think Mackey is a philosopher of science and an analytic philosopher. So if you thought that analytic philosophy is just Bertrand Russell talking about numbers and Frege talking about sets from our past episodes, this is a good example of somebody using just very analytical methods. Let's lay out all the arguments, step one, step two, step three, and trying to be exhaustive in how he's approaching it.
That's a good word.
So you found the experience of reading this a little much?
It was exhaustive.
Exhausting.
I found that it's a bit of a tough read at first. I think it's difficult to get back into cosmological and ontological and all of those things that you kind of have an idea of, but it's getting thrown back into the jargon of philosophy 101.
Yeah, well, we name-dropped those things a lot, and we thought it was time that we got serious about them. In fact, in the Schleiermacher episode, when I name-dropped them, I did it in such a hasty way that somebody accused Wes and me of not knowing the difference between the two, of not knowing what we were talking about at all.
Which was nonsense.
But now, for sure, since we've read this, we know hopefully what we're talking about. And I guess the challenge, though, with something this analytical and lengthy that he just goes on and on about every one of these arguments is getting enough of the sense of this communicated so we're not violating our ground rule to, oh, just go read the book yourself. You'll get it. We have to get enough substance in there that something is conveyed.
Perhaps you should mention what our ground rules are.
Well, Robert, our token theist from South Africa, as a result of that same line of criticism to our Schleiermacher, I thought we should get somebody that at least would admit to being theist.
I remember there's definitely a rule about no name dropping.
Okay. Unfortunately, since this is like a secondary work that we're dealing with, there is kind of a lot of name dropping.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to stick to that rule. It's certainly a rule that Mackey doesn't take too seriously. He name drops all over the place.
But he cashes out. He says, here's an objection from Newman, or, you know, from whoever. Here's an argument from this guy and this guy. I don't think he just says, and Nietzsche wouldn't have liked that either, and then moves on, you know.
Fair enough.
Do you remember anything else?
Yeah, we've got to be rigorous and exact in all we say, unless it would be more humorous not to.
Well, there you go. And we're going to try to assume that our audience has not read, certainly has not read this book, but does not have a philosophy background. So I think some of the more interesting parts of this Mackey book are the arcana of the ontological and cosmological arguments, talking about necessary beings and contingency of the universe and things like that. So we'll try to decode all that enough to follow what we're talking about. Robert, tell the folks a little about why you're here, who you are, about your blog, etc.
I am a commenter on the Partially Examined Life blog, and I have my own blog called outsideofeden.com, where I cover topics around spirituality, atheism, theism, pop culture, music, and I think I'm evidence that if you comment on other people's blogs, good things happen to you.
Well, the fact that you are somebody who was evidently sympathetic to theistic positions, but was not mad at us, that was the key.
That's a very small subset of the population.
Yeah, commenting in and of itself is not a guarantee of good things happening.
Humorously and constructively.
Yeah. The comments have to be good comments.
Yes. And plus, I went to your blog and it was good. There were interesting things on it. So
yeah, I try to cover, you know, what would be the theology of a Simpsons episode or a Bruce Springsteen song. And while doing that, I seem to annoy people on both sides of the spectrum, both atheists and theists. So I consider that probably a sign that I'm doing something right.
And I remember when we talked before, you were a bit skeptical about all these proofs yourself, right?
Yeah, I think as an outsider, I look at Mackey's work and it seems to be a lot of philosophical self-referencing. Outsiders, I think, especially people who would consider themselves believers or of faith, don't really have any of these arguments as the reason why they believe in God. So it's not as though people were objectively, academically looking at the ontological argument and decided, bang, I better believe in God. And I feel like this work doesn't really address that issue. It seems to assume that most people actually do have a rational reason for believing in God, and they've kind of gone through the philosophical arguments themselves, but they're somehow defective and need to be talked out of them.
Or at least he's within an academic tradition and is trying to make some sort of advances in pushing group knowledge forward, as opposed to whatever individual idiosyncratic reason that you may have that is entirely private and incommunicable for believing.
I think it's a hard one because you do have this weight of tradition, people like Aquinas and Descartes and all their arguments for God, but it's not like you see that in the real world. Outside of the ivory towers of academia, people in church aren't exactly making all of the arguments, although some of them they are. So I think certainly the discussions around morality, what's the source of our sense of right and wrong, is maybe something you might hear in a church, but you're probably unlikely to hear the ontological argument in a church.
Yes.
Very unlikely.
You know, an important question is whether whatever one's motivations for believing in God, whether one can do that rationally. So, for instance, since Kant and Hume, most people have accepted that the arguments for the existence of God fail in some way. And what Mackey here is doing is recounting some of that and refining them a little bit in some cases. But Kant himself thought that despite the fact that those arguments fail, one could still have practical reasons for believing in God, and then William James' pragmatic reasons, which Mackey touches on briefly. But there's still a case to be made that one can have reasons to believe in God and rationally believe in God, even if one's fundamental motivations are simply faith, are not themselves rational. You know, here's a demonstrative argument, therefore I believe in God. And I think that's what you were getting at, Robert.
Yeah, I agree. I think the one area where perhaps people at least seem to think that they have approached it rationally is the argument for design. So you'll often hear people argue very convincingly that the reason why they believe is because they've looked at the design argument. That and possibly the morality argument are probably the two that really extend into popular culture.
And ironically, I think the cosmological argument is probably the strongest if you were to rate these arguments.
Well, I think the difference between where Kant was historically and where Mackey is coming in is Kant was reacting to a tradition that thought you could prove deductively that God exists, right? With certainty. He's coming out of this Cartesian tradition. And after Kant, so Swinburne, the guy that Mackey is chiefly responding to, does not really try to argue very much deductively. It's all inductive and with a great respect for scientific method. Swinburne thinks that really the idea of a creator God is the simplest possible hypothesis to explain For instance, the wonders of creation that we see around us, the commonality in all things, like explaining why the laws of nature are what they are in the first place. He seems to think that there's something missing if we take a merely scientific. Science is great. Science's explanations are right. He accepts the theory of evolution, Swinburne does, but says even given all that, there's something unsatisfying. There's something that still needs to be explained. This is a point of disagreement. Mackey is going to come down against him, but this is what he has in mind. So when we hit the cosmological argument, I mean, that's traditionally a deductive argument. You know, if everything for sure has a cause, there must be a first cause. Well, Swinburne has an inductive version of it. It's more likely than not.
Right.
Which is a much more modern, I think that made this book. What I really liked about Mackey is even when he's, you know, he spends a lot of time talking specifically about what Descartes said, what Thomas Aquinas said, but he tries to pull these arguments out of their original settings to some extent, because it's too easy if you're just reading, especially Kant, who's so filled with his own vocabulary, to try to pull it out of a Kantian context and see, is there anything, you know, that your man on the street would find valuable about? How can we rephrase, say, one of Descartes' arguments so it's detached from Descartes' whole project? Like, is it still useful in some other way? Any other initial impressions, or should we just jump to the first one?
I think we should jump to the first one.
Well, I thought we might want to start with his chapter two. Mackey's chapter one is on Hume's argument against miracles, which we've at least mentioned in our past Hume epistemology episode. But chapter two is when he talks about Descartes' initial argument in his third meditation for the existence of God, which I think longtime listeners, that was our, episode number two. And at the time we talked in depth about the first two meditations and then just got to meditation three and said, oh my God, he just has this horrible argument for the existence of God. It's so bad, I'm not even going to tell you what it is. And then dissolved in snickering, and that was kind of the end of it. So I feel like I owe the listeners 3 years later, whatever it is, some sort of more detailed account. And actually, contrary to my memory of this, Descartes is well known for having a version of the ontological argument, which is Anselm's old argument. And he does, but that's in meditation five. In meditation three here, the one he actually does. So remember, Descartes has been arguing, he's doubting everything, and he wants to come up with something indubitable that will ground everything else. Well, the fact that he is thinking right now, that's indubitable. And from there, he gets this principle of whatever it is that I clearly and distinctly understand, that seems to be true. In the process of doing this, one of the steps is to show there's a God, just by examining the contents of his consciousness alone, the contents of his mind, his ideas. So in that sense, this first argument is a version of the ontological argument because it's going just from an idea to the being of God. Somebody else want to actually tell how we want to read it?
Essentially, the argument is that ideas come from somewhere. If you think of a dog, it's because you've seen a dog, or even something like a unicorn. You've seen a horn and a horse. So you can put the two together and your ideas are based on a form of reality. But God is not quite as simple as that. You've never seen infinity or perfection in that sense. So it's almost as though God had to put it there.
And one of the key pieces is because the idea, it's clearly and distinctly perceived.
Correct. So it's not something that he can doubt or his senses might deceive him. He's got a clear perception of it, which counts as an authority for him.
Right. For this purpose, it just, you know, we don't have to give a whole definition of God. It's just an infinite being. Having the idea of an infinite being at all, it means that infinity itself is not a report, like you were saying, of something we've seen. He also, I think the other key point is that there are two sources that an idea could have. One of them is because we've actually seen or experienced the thing. The other is, well, maybe my own mind just came up with it itself. And he thinks that that might be possible for lots of things. But he, for some reason, even if you think, and again, this is sort of leaving Descartes' project because he hadn't proved the existence of himself as a physical object or his brain or anything like this. But you might say, my brain is a physical object, and that has plenty of causal power to produce any sort of wispy idea that's going to flit across it. But in this case, the idea of infinity, well, my brain is not infinitely large. How could I have this idea of infinity at all, of an infinite being, without it coming from somewhere that's not my brain and not something I've seen, right?
Yeah, Mackey, on page 36 and 37, he gives this nice little summary. He's paraphrasing Descartes. I have this remarkable concept of God, of an infinitely powerful and infinitely perfect being, creator and sustainer of the whole universe. The content of this concept cannot have been built up out of other mental contents, nor can it have been derived in any ordinary way from the perception of material things, or from my awareness of myself and of the operations of my mind. It is also quite different from the ideas of the various secondary qualities for which it is plausible to suppose that my own mind, in conjunction with my senses, is somehow responsible. From what source, then, can the content of this concept be derived? This must be an extramental entity, which actually possesses the features of which this content includes representations. That is to say, an actually existing, infinitely perfect being. And by secondary qualities, he's talking about, say, the qualitative feeling of something being red as arising from, say, the interaction of different wavelengths of light and our brain. So someone might argue that God is like a secondary quality. And
by secondary qualities, like color,
yeah,
that maybe a lot of philosophers think there's not color actually in the world.
Right.
It's just something
right.
that we're reacting maybe to some interaction with the world, but our mind is making that up.
There you go. So God is not just made up like a secondary quality based on some interaction between mind and world.
And it's important to note that the point of this is to prove the existence of God, not the attributes of the idea. There's an idea of God as being infinite, omnipotent, and so on and so forth. And there's a step you have to take where you say that necessary existence is contained in that idea. It's like it's, I don't want to use the term property because that's kind of an issue, but necessary existence is a necessary part of the idea of an infinite, omnipotent, omniscient God that Descartes has.
The way you're phrasing it, I think slides over shows exactly how close, even though this version in Meditation 3 is not technically the ontological argument, it slides very naturally to his version in number 5, which is the updated version of the classic proof from Saint Anselm. But in this version here, in number 3, like it doesn't mention specifically that he has to have a necessary existence. It's just that infinity is so huge, somebody
right.
must have put it there.
Yeah, one is making a sort of argument about causes. It's almost like a cross between the cosmological and ontological. You're saying God has to be there as the cause of the concept.
Gotcha.
Whereas Anselm's argument is more about logical consistency or a sort of analytic derivation from a concept.
So the question is kind of, could you have an idea of infinity if there was no such thing? Could you get by just adding numbers together or objects together the idea of infinity or the idea of an absolute omnipotent God? Or would the idea require existence?
Right. The idea of infinity must be caused by this actually infinite thing. Whereas one might argue, as Mackie does, that in fact we get this concept of infinity. It comes from an idea of a limit or something that's progressively increasing something, let's say, towards a limit.
Yeah, well, I think Mackie also touches on the idea that this is quite similar to Plato's theory of forms, not to start off by name dropping, but the idea of, I've never seen a straight line or a perfect circle in the world. My eyes have never seen it. I've only seen approximations of it, but I have a sense that it's real, so it must exist somewhere. And it's essentially a version of this argument that Descartes is using, that I've got this idea that I've never seen, and my ideas come from somewhere, so it must be real.
Whereas the response to that is that this form is a negative or limiting notion of a perfectly straight line that you get at by the idea is that, this thing is straighter than another. It's not perfectly straight because it's a real thing in the world. But once you have the idea of something being straighter, you can gradually increase that towards a limit, and the limiting notion, that which nothing is straighter, is your form. But it doesn't have to exist because it can just be built up out of your common everyday experience.
So you don't buy Plato's response to that, which is, how do we even see that one thing is a progression on another thing without having already in mind this limit to compare it to? How do we know that this line is straighter than that line if we didn't already have the notion of straight, which is really the notion of perfectly straight, which is the notion of an infinite?
Yeah, I think that's an argument that Mackie doesn't deal with, right?
Not that I notice. He just seems to give the answer that I usually give in these discussions about that, which is, no, I don't actually have a notion of infinity. It's all a negative notion, which is one that Descartes explicitly considers right there. So we're getting to a point, I think this is our first example, where something just seems obvious. Like, just seems obvious to him. He clearly and distinctly has a positive notion of infinity in his head, and yet others disagree. So we're just always going to agree to disagree? Like, what...
I think the problem is that you can't experience infinity. It's not like you could ever look at a really large pile of coins and say, that's infinity. And I'm not sure how you get outside of Descartes' mind. I don't know how you take that idea out of Descartes' mind and be able to examine it in an objective way. I don't think you can get out of his head.
Well, but we all share it. I mean, so Swinburne really thinks infinity is simple. So my references to Swinburne here, the books that Mackie is reacting to are like three different books from 1977 through 81, The Coherence of Theism, The Existence of God, Faith and Reason, mostly those three. The one I have in my hand here is a much shorter version just called Is There a God from 1996. And it is, he actually talks about Mackie for a second in like the last page saying, look, I know Mackie's already responded to this, but I still think what I'm saying is reasonable. So he doesn't really respond to Mackie. It's just a shortened, easy to read version of it that I skimmed through. So he thinks that infinity is the simplest explanation. Of course, we have a notion of infinity in our heads. It's the very large that is difficult to hold in our heads. Like, you know, a million billion. I don't have that number in my head, but infinity, it's a completely simple, understandable thing. Of course, we aren't experiencing it in the way we're experiencing a single or two or three things in front of us.
I think the objection here as well is that just because you can conceive of something doesn't mean it exists. So you can conceive of, say, a unicorn. Its existence is not implied by that conception of the unicorn. And I think that's the objection to this argument, that yes, you can conceive of infinity, you can conceive of perception, you can conceive of omnipotence, but that doesn't lead to existence.
Well, I think it sounds like all the gravity is pulling us into a consideration of the ontological argument proper. So this particular one in Meditation 3 is just about, is the notion of infinity in our heads so huge it must have been caused by an infinite thing? Not just does it prove that an infinite thing exists, because of course, Descartes thinks there are lots of things in our heads, like unicorns, you were saying, that don't exist in real life. It's just that in that case, the amount of reality, he says, that our formal reality that our minds have has is completely sufficient to give us the objective reality, he considers, in other words, the reality of the idea considered as an object in our heads of the notion of a unicorn. But that doesn't work with infinity in this concept.
Mark, that's a good point, is that this version of Descartes' argument does rely on his notion of clarity and distinctness of ideas. Because what he's going to say is the clarity and distinctness of the idea of the unicorn, it's lacking something because there are no unicorns you actually ever perceived. So Descartes is going to say that your idea of a unicorn is never going to be as clear and distinct as your idea of a horse, and that there's something essential there. But he thinks that his idea of God is as clear and distinct, so to speak, as his idea of a horse or chair or anything like that, which, as you already mentioned, is debatable. You can say that, but when Descartes says, by God, I understand a substance infinite, independent, all-knowing, all-powerful, and by which I myself and every other thing that exists were created. If you could actually clearly and distinctly conceive of such a thing, then you might very well question how it got into your head, which is exactly what he does. But the first objection is, you probably don't have as clear and distinct an idea as you think you do. And then the second objection is to take on the notion of causality, right? Because that's really what it hinges on, is it says, okay, if you do have this clear and distinct idea, and ideas are always generated from somewhere, and you could not have generated that idea yourself from your experience or what have you, then something else must have generated and stuck it in your brain.
Yep.
And that thing is God.
And I think it's that last point, which is Mackie's objection, that ideas don't necessarily have to come from perception. That you can experience it as a negative. You're aware of your own limitations and imperfections, so therefore you can conceive of perfection, even though you would never attain perfection.
Yes.
What I find interesting here, before we jump to the ontological argument proper, is that both Mackie and Descartes here, they agree that we do have this idea in our head. That is, the idea of an infinite being is coherent. And that's just an initial line that you could object to before any of this gets off the ground. And actually reading the Swinburne, I think it was a little persuasive to me in talking me out of this. So there are two kinds of theologians, that one might be in the tradition of Aquinas and Descartes and these guys who really think that the fundamental notions are reasonable and understandable. Now, of course, we don't know what it's like to be an infinite being because we're not. But we can understand that. That's a perfectly simple notion. And then there's this version that's come up in like our Taoism discussion and our Schleiermacher discussion, that the infinite is so huge that we don't have it in our head. We could never even really conceive of it. There's nothing we can say about God. It's all going to fall into apparent self-contradiction, but it's a pregnant self-contradiction. You know, what is truly important can't be said. It's not something that reason can get a hold of. So I think about those medieval dilemmas, like, can God create a rock bigger than he can lift? That you might just say that's like a Zen koan, that you just contemplate the divine and say, ultimately, it's beyond human understanding and we shouldn't be making these rational arguments in the first place. But this is the other tradition. This is natural theology. So Swinburne just says, no, God can't make a rock bigger than he can lift. And that doesn't mean he's not omnipotent, but omnipotent is being able to do everything that there is to do. If something violates the law of logic, it is not a valid option for anyone to do, no matter how powerful they are. So Swinburne himself, I don't want to go into the details on this, but he has to make some tough decisions, I think, and depart from maybe what your average theist would believe, even though he's a Catholic and trying to sort of represent the Thomas Aquinas traditional position. Like, he thinks that the notion of God outside of time doesn't make any sense to him. If God's an object, God exists in time. Well, God's a special kind of object that exists at all places and was present from all times, but he doesn't exist outside of the stream of time. And so in the same way that you can't do everything, like violate the laws of logic, God can't know, for instance, the future actions of free people, because he gave us freedom. We exist in time. He exists in time, even though all of the time. He's not above time looking upon our future. So that's another sort of traditional paradox. How can we be free, yet God knows what we're going to do? Well, according to Swinburne, who's trying his best to make this all rational, God doesn't know what we're going to do. I think that's why Mackey doesn't consider this objection at all. There should be a whole chapter on it, as far as I'm concerned, that the notion of God is just internally incoherent. But he's starting with Swinburne's notion, I think, which is something like, I don't know, maybe Descartes or Aquinas hadn't thought it out completely, but they're definitely pushing on the same purely rationalist, understandable notion of God.
Can I make a reference to an earlier episode?
I've done it 5 times already.
So when we did the Philosophy of Mind episode, we read Nagel's article, What Is It Like to Be a Bat?
Yeah.
Yep.
And the conclusion is we don't know what it's like to be a bat, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I find interesting is this bit about, well, I have this clear and distinct idea of God. And this clear and distinct idea of God is not just the infinite, right? It's omnipotent, omniscient, infinite,
perfectly good,
you know, self-generating, all these things. If I can't even have a concept, and maybe I'm making an error here, but if I don't even know what it's like to be a bat, how could I possibly have any idea of what it's like to be God? And therefore, how could my idea of God be anything more than the kind of idea I have of a bat? It's furry, it falls in this phylum, et cetera, et cetera. In which case, it's not a very rich idea.
Well, you're not asking what it's like to be God, though. You are just asking about the God equivalents of furry and all that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that the content of that idea is not robust enough to warrant needing a source outside of myself.
Yeah, well, I think the clear and distinct thing really gets us into the ontological arguments, because the work it's doing there for Descartes is that it's sort of conceptual or analytic, right? In the same way that the idea of a mountain can't be separated from that of a valley, you can't separate the idea of God from that of God's existence. So the clearness and distinctness there is meant to get you towards this comparison of, say, idea of God with mathematical ideas, where it's very, very clear that one thing follows analytically or definitionally from another. And so the idea here is that it should be very clear that God's existence follows almost definitionally from his concept. I mean, I agree with you that is it really a clear and distinct idea? Not in any robust sense, right?
I think if you say, oh, well, God is all-knowing, that's
it's almost obscure, meaningless. Yeah.
I would hardly call it clear and distinct.
Yeah.
To the extent you would need to have somebody implant it in your brain.
Right. So somebody want to give a version, maybe Descartes' version of the Meditation 5 ontological argument proper with perfections?
I might have done that earlier, but here's this. I have an idea of a supremely perfect being, i.e. a being having all perfections. Necessary existence is a perfection. Therefore, a supremely perfect being exists. How's that?
Yep. Yeah. Short and sweet.
Thank you, Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy.
So we'd responded to this on some episodes before with like Kant's version with, oh, you can't say that existence is one of the perfections, because even if a perfection means every attribute that is perfect, something has every good attribute, but existing is not an attribute at all. It's not a property. It's something that it does. That's seems to be the way Kant put it. And so that got codified in formal logic with the quantifiers and in our Frege episode, Frege or our Russell episodes, we talked about how you just don't even give it the same symbology. So if you say X is green, you might say GX, where G is green, but you can't make existence a predicate like that. You have to use a quantifier and say there is such an X, such that X has this property. And there is such a, is just a completely different thing logically than these other things.
Yeah, and Mackie will sidestep that and make us agnostics on whether existence can be a property because he thinks that there's a more fundamental objection.
And I like that.
Mackie will open up the possibility of saying there exists an X such that X is G and X exists. But then you have to think about the relationship between your two different uses there of X exists, where you're using exists as a predicate, and then this quantifier, this existential quantifier, there exists an X such that.
I think we should use the example of the re-Martian here that Mackie uses.
What page is that on?
So page 41 at the top.
Mackie uses an example of saying that a Martian exists is different from saying something like a re-Martian exists, where re-Martian is defined as a Martian who exists. So existence is contained in the definition. Then from that, you say it's illogical to say a re-Martian does not exist. It's self-contradictory. And this is the kind of argument that Descartes is making. He's begged the question by saying God exists. And so therefore he proves a logical contradiction to say God does not exist.
And this is Kant's argument against which Mackie is going to say, we don't need to accept this. So for Kant, Kant is just going to come out with existence can't be a predicate.
Yeah, you can't have re-Martian.
You can't have a re-Martian. And that's a kind of vague and unsupported, that's a question that's complex enough that Mackie doesn't want to get into it. He wants to leave that open, the idea of whether existence can be a predicate. So by the time Mackie is done with this, you can have a concept of re-Martian, but you can coherently say it is not the case that there exists an X such that X is a re-Martian, which breaks down to you can say it is not the case that there exists an X such that X is a Martian and X exists. In other words, you can treat existence as a predicate and then deny that something exists with that predicate.
Right, deny that it is instantiated.
Exactly. Right.
So that's the way Mackie doesn't say there are two senses of existence. He just says, fine, let's let existence be a predicate and say, you can define any new concept with existence in it. I don't mean Santa Claus. I mean the existent Santa Claus that I'll call Schmanta Claus. You know, you can make up any concept like that. There's nothing to prevent you from doing that. What would? There's no limits like that on how concepts can work. But the question is, no matter what kind of concept you come up with, is it instantiated? Is there some object in the world that corresponds to that or not?
Right. The idea of its existing does not automatically guarantee its existence or its instantiation. And it's perfectly fine to have a concept where the idea of its existing is built into that concept. But then again, you can coherently deny that such a thing is instantiated or such a thing exists.
Yeah, it's almost like the problem of studying economics, that you can build a system that is logically consistent from start to finish and say A, therefore B, and it's all completely logically consistent, but it doesn't mean that it'll actually apply in the real world.
Right.
Same problem here.
Or Freud's whole psychological, you can make this internally consistent system. That's a name drop. You can listen.
So we can make all these claims about how a re-Martian has the concept of existence built into its definition. It's logically consistent to say a re-Martian exists, but it doesn't mean that in reality, in itself, there is such a thing as a re-Martian that you could touch. That's the problem.
The objection is obvious, like that things that are in your head should not, the contents of your ideas should not indicate the contents of what's outside of your mind. But I mean, that's everybody listen. People are have not taken many philosophy classes or don't have the patience who are listening to this are just like, why are you dwelling on this? This is so obviously stupid. But saying exactly what is wrong with it, it sounds so. In our Schopenhauer episode, Schopenhauer just said there are different realms that the principle of sufficient reason applies. And what that means exactly here doesn't matter so much. But just the fact that the kinds of explanations you give for what goes on in the sequence of ideas in your head is different than the kind of explanations that you give to the sequence of what goes on in the world. And there's no, those don't connect in such a way that anything that's in your head should indicate that anything outside what's in the world. And so the question is that just a way of capturing a well-understood fact, or is it just solving the matter by fiat? It sounds like that Kant or Frege creating this notation that just says, look, existence isn't a predicate. I've written it as a quantifier. It's not a predicate. That sounds like you're solving it by definition, that you're not really engaging. It's Schopenhauer's move, which I think reflects our common sense reply to this. Is that sufficient? Or have we hit another point that, oh, well, that it seems reasonable to me that those things wouldn't interact. Oh, but it seems reasonable to me that they would. And we must agree to disagree. And there's something unanalyzable about what seems reasonable to us. That's what so much of this argument, of any of these arguments, come down to.
I think the problem is that it's sort of, again, the radical Cartesian doubt that once you start to doubt everything outside of your experience, you can't actually reason your way out of your mind. I mean, Descartes argued that you could, but you actually can't reason from your own perception out to reality. There is no escape from radical doubt. I think that's essentially what Mackey dismisses all of these arguments as. Once you doubt your experiences, it's almost impossible to get back to the reality outside of your head. However well you think you can conceive of something, you'll never get to existence out of that.
Mm. So you think that Mackey thinks that of all of the ontological proofs, including Anselm's?
Yeah, I think Anselm is just a version of this.
Which would be a way of saying there's no way to get to existence from concepts. You don't even need to go the radical doubt route. If your goal is to try to prove the existence of God from a concept through reason, quote-unquote, pure reason, whatever, you'll just never get there because there's something fundamentally disconnected between concepts of things and the existence of things.
Yeah, or as Mackey puts it, we must still go outside of the concept in order to ascribe existence to the object, even if the concept contains the idea of existence.
Yeah, as paradoxical as that sounds. And I think it's easier to see that, you're right, Robert, in Descartes' thing, he's specifically in Cartesian doubt, he's doubted everything, how is he going to get outside that? In Anselm's, well, it's put a little differently, it's more considering the concept itself. Maybe this is a difference that's not a difference, I'm not sure yet. But it's considering God as, let's define him as a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. And so if you have in your head, the fool, he says, has this idea, he accepts the definition of God as a being which nothing greater can be conceived, but also thinks that this does not exist.
Anselm would say to the fool, right, you've got this idea in your mind of something that there is nothing greater than that idea in your mind. And then the immediate follow-up is, you know, once the fool agrees to that point, he's sort of in the trap. And Anselm says, right, well, wouldn't a God who actually exists be greater than the idea in your own mind? Therefore, God exists.
Yeah. So how is that? Have we already given the response? What additional response is needed to that version over what we've already said?
Well, it's the Remartian thing over again. The fool's judgment that this concept is not realized does not commit him into reading non-existence back into the content of that concept, which is what he would need to involve him in incoherence. You can allow existence as a predicate, and you can allow a concept to rope existence in, and then you are committed to, it is incoherent to say, for instance, the Remartian doesn't exist, which when you parse it out logically is, would be there exists an X such that X is a Remartian, and X does not exist. That's incoherent. But that doesn't rope you into, it is not the case that no Remartians exist. It is not the case that there exists an X such that X is a Remartian. That is not inconsistent with the Remartian with the predicate of existence. I mean, it gets logically thorny there, but if you... So basically, the idea is that there's no incoherence. There's no incoherence in both allowing that that which nothing greater can be seen must have the predicate of existence, okay, but then also allowing that it's not instantiated, that one must always go outside of the concept for instantiation.
I think there's an objection that Mackey raises, which is, I think, based on a monk whose name is escaping me now, who says you could apply the same reasoning to this concept of a perfect island. So you could say, I've got this concept in my mind of a perfect island. Well, wouldn't a perfect island that's actually out there be better than my concept? Therefore, the perfect island exists.
But Anselm responds to that. Yeah, he says that there's something, a dissimilarity between the perfect island concept and the perfect God concept.
Well his argument would be that God is greater than this perfect island. So the perfect island isn't the most awesome thing ever conceived.
So that means the perfect island doesn't have to exist? But
correct.
Comparing the different perfect islands, the existent one and the non-existent one, it still seems like it should work. Even if there's a non-island altogether that's more perfect, if it worked at all...
This is all gets addressed, by the way, on page 52. As soon as Anselm's proof became known, it was criticized by Guanilo, writing on behalf of the fool. He says, if Anselm's proof is valid, we could equally validly prove the existence somewhere in the ocean of the imaginary lost island that surpasses in its attractions all inhabited countries. For actually existing is an essential element in such superiority. I guess he tried to tap into the same greater than part of the idea. So in this case, what Guanilo is saying is, well, I have an idea of an island than which nothing greater can be conceived. Therefore, that island must exist. And Anselm has to go back and say there's a difference between...
Well, it surpasses in its attractions all inhabited countries.
Right.
So it's a specific kind of perfection.
a specific kind of perfection.
Yeah.
Right.
And Anselm's response is that, and I'm looking at 53, the same page that you were just talking about, Seth. It's the very bottom paragraph that Mackey begins to describe it. But going on to 54, his reply to the Lost Island argument is that, whereas that island can be conceived not to exist, God, or being than which nothing greater can be conceived, cannot. And this would be a good reply, pointing to a real distinction, if Anselm were right in saying it is possible to conceive of being which cannot be conceived not to exist. In other words, the island depends on one perfection. It's about the attractions, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas God, we're talking about all perfections, all realities, and then which requires existence.
Yeah, I mean, I don't find the Lost Island objection particularly convincing. Structurally, the argument has the same. You might say that the argument is logically sound but not valid. Is that the right? I'm afraid to talk about logic after I screwed up this post so many years ago, last year. But having perfection in attractions and, let's say, natural features, you know, like waterfalls and lakes and mountains and such, is not the same thing as having perfect being in the sense that St. Anselm is talking about God. So I don't find that a particularly convincing objection myself. Not that I believe Anselm's proof, but I just don't think that's a very robust objection. I think where Mackey talks about how Anselm is just subject to the same thing as Descartes, and he does that at the beginning of 52. He just says there's a close analogy between Anselm's and Descartes, and a correspondingly between the vital criticism. If you have an X explicitly or implicitly includes existence, then you are begging the question.
Yeah, essentially all of the ontological proofs are a form of disguising existence within the definition of God.
Yes.
Which is invalid.
I don't think that's it. You can say it's begging the question, but that's like saying analyzing the concept of a circle and coming up with, it's an analytic derivation. So what you do is you start out with a concept and then you analyze the concept. So yes, it's analytic. Yes, it's a priori. And existence should fall out simply out of the concept. But that doesn't imply begging the question as long as you agree on the concept. Critically, you have to agree to the idea that God has all perfections. And then you have to agree to the idea that existence is one of these perfections. There's some critical conceptual premises there. But once you've done that, you can go validly from God is that which is nothing greater can be conceived to the concept of God necessarily contains the predicate of existence. That's fine. But that doesn't get you to instantiation or to actual existence. And that's the critical part.
You can't get off the piece of paper, basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
You can get existence. That's very good. You can get existence on paper. But yeah, you can't go farther than that.
When you started talking about him being a necessary being, that if God exists, that he has to exist. I mean, that seems like if God exists at all, then it couldn't have been just an accident that God exists. Like either God is the fundamental cause of all the universe and the thing underlying it, or he's not. It's not that, well, he is, but he might not have been.
Right.
So one of the variations off this, which just I only want to bring up because it's a contemporary line and it brought me back
to our
symbolic logic course.
Modal logic.
Modal logic. Yes. Which is just to say, if you're saying that something necessarily exists, the way you interpret that in modal logic is it exists in all possible worlds.
Worst development in the history of philosophy.
Well, and you could even take this example as a demonstration of how goofy it is or how complicated it has to get for it to make any sense because
Plantinga. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's one of the names that comes up in terms of like the guys arguing against the new atheists. Plantinga is still active today.
I'm sorry. Can I just read this? Well, go ahead and set your preface.
Actually, Mackey throws out a little barb again, you know.
I know. I love it. That's what I want to
read. Oh, you're going to read? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Plantinga is a fairly famous philosopher and well-respected and I guess helped to develop. Is that right? Or is he just did he use
No, he's just using modal logic.
Yeah. So planning to put forward a proof using modal logic. But I just want to read this paragraph from Mackey. It says, some knowledge of Plantinga's argument and the general suggestion that modal logic may rescue philosophical theology from the criticisms of Hume and Kant and their empiricist or positivist successors has begun to leak out from purely philosophical discussions and to receive wider publicity. So perhaps St. Alvin, that's Plantinga's first name, will eventually take his place beside St. Anselm. At least he should have no difficulty in meeting the miracle working requirement for canonization after the success that he has achieved in subverting, as Hume would say, all the principles of the understanding of so many intelligent readers.
Bang.
Smackdown.
Yeah, I love it.
So the quick version of his argument is just, if God exists, then he necessarily exists. And it's possible that God exists. So to translate that in modal logic terms, right, as far as we know, God could exist or could not exist. So that means it's possible God exists. That means God does exist in at least one possible world, right? Maybe not right. This one. We don't know.
But that means he necessarily exists in that possible world.
Exactly.
Which means he necessarily exists in all possible worlds.
Including this one. So, yeah.
But it is a misuse of modal logic because it relies on this idea of world index properties. Should we try and explain this? Do we want to get into this?
No.
Okay.
No.
There's a version of this that's listed on the Stanford site that we might be able to say it without getting into all the nonsense.
Yeah, that's good.
The trick is, you say, it's possible that God exists. That seems like an uncontroversial claim. It's possible that God exists. Of course, it's possible, right? But then what you do is you say, well, but God is a necessary being. So whatever properties God has, they are necessary properties. So if it's possible that God exists, then it has to be necessity because God doesn't do anything contingently. God is only necessary. So if you admit possibility, then you're essentially opening the door to the necessity of God's existence.
Which is quite a leap.
Yes.
Well, and it was explained to us in the logic class that at least Wes and I had together that you can see how this doesn't work because it should also work the opposite way. It's possible God doesn't exist. And it seems right. like if God doesn't exist, he necessarily doesn't exist. So,
well, Plantinga brings that up as well
right.
to his credit, as Mackie says.
So. Yes, he merely thinks it's more reasonable. So right. one of those things has to be true. One of the arguments has to go forward. And he thinks inductively, a reasonable person would lean in favor of the positive one. And I don't know if I remember why he says that. Mackie doesn't agree. He thinks there's absolutely no way of deciding between the two, right?
So it says, the premise that it is just possible that there should be something unsurpassably great looks innocent. We are usually ready enough to concede that something, however extravagant, is possible and to confine our critical scrutiny to the question of whether or not it is not merely possible but actual. But unsurpassable greatness, essentially given the necessary nature of God, is a Trojan horse, not an innocent little possibility. So Mackie's pointing out that what you're actually talking about when you're talking about possibility is possibility versus actuality and not possibility versus necessity, or there's whatever is even possibly necessary is necessary. It's like he says, a Trojan horse, that what you really want to know is if you say it's possible that God exists and it's possible that God doesn't exist, what you really want to know is whether or not God exists.
Right. You're not getting at what properties would follow from him existing or would follow from him not existing, and one of those backtracking and begging the question.
In any case, if you were to go back to what Robert was talking about at the beginning of the episode, people who have faith are actually worried about the existence of God. This is not going to help them. Nobody out there who's looking for a rational defense or a rational proof of the existence of God is going to go to Plantinga and possible world semantics. It's not going to happen. You'd be much better off sticking with Anselm.
Let me add to that. Swinburne's, I'm quoting from the very end of his book, which is an epilogue called So What? This is after he's gone through a lot of these arguments. He says he's well aware of objections that others have to these arguments. Some of these objections have been around for many centuries. And then he refers to Mackie's as a modern version of these. I'm also aware of counter objections, which can be advanced in turn against every objection to my views, and also the need for qualification and amplification of most of the assertions in this book. Argument and counter argument, qualification and amplification can go on forever. But religion is not exceptional in this respect. With respect to any subject, whatever, the discussion can go on forever. But life is short, and we have to act on the basis of what such evidence as we have had time to investigate shows on balance to be probably true. And he gives a lot of examples of that kind of stuff. So even someone who's a hardcore rationalist, the way Swinburne is going to say, look, you can keep going back and forth, and just it comes down to some kind of judgment call by intelligent people.
My favorite kind of topic.
So, cosmological...
So can we say we've effectively kicked out the ontological argument?
Oh, yes.
Consigned it to history.
Well, it's still alive and well, just in the same way we could echo what Swinburne said about this podcast if we were to continue to go down all of the ontological arguments out there.
We have to make a judgment call, and a judgment call is to next argument.
So the cosmological one has several versions, and one of them is very close to the ontological version, which is, you know, everything is contingent. Everything, it seems like it could have been there, it could have not been there. This house, maybe somebody didn't build it. Maybe the earth could have just not developed in the first place. It could have just been kicked into the sun. But it seems like everything is explained by something else. Like, well, why did this house here? Because builders built it. Well, where did the builders come from? There's always some kind of explanation, even for the earth itself. Those can't go back forever, says this argument. There has to be some just necessary being that all these contingent things rely on in some way. And the different versions of this argument are whether you interpret that contingency in a strictly causal matter in time. There has to be a first cause at the beginning of the universe that kicked everything off. And, oh, that must be God. Or whether you say God is in a being that exists beyond time. Maybe even the causal sequence is infinite, but there still has to be something for that whole sequence not to be resting on nothing. There has to be a foundational thing. And so, again, taking Swinburne's tack, man, God is the simplest possible explanation. God is way simpler than thinking there are infinitely many or many, many individual quarks or something. Like, how do you explain how they're all quarks and how they're all similar? It's no, the unitary fundamental explanation behind it would be God.
Yeah, and part of the explanation for simplicity there, I think, is the idea that God's mind is the cause and mind is more simple in some sense.
Right, it doesn't have parts.
Doesn't have parts. I consider this to be the strongest of the arguments, actually.
Including the mind piece?
I think it's strong in the sense of, even if you've accepted all of Mackey's objections, which I basically do, I think what all parties seem to agree on is that there's some sort of necessary being or beings, where necessary means the being or beings that terminate the explanatory chain or the causal chain. So you could say ultimate particles. For instance, you could make a plausible claim that there are many necessary beings or the ultimate particles of the universe, the things that can no longer be divided, the things which are not themselves caused, whose properties don't have any explanation. I couldn't subdivide those particles and explain the properties of that fundamental particle based on something else. That makes it a necessary being. Any being at which the chain of explanation ends is a necessary being. And so the argument between the theists and the non-theists there becomes, does a necessary being have to be non-naturalistic or stand outside of the natural order? Why not treat the universe itself as a necessary being? Which is another way of saying, well, there is no explanation. The universe just is, and that's its necessity. It is uncaused. You begin with the Big Bang, but beyond the Big Bang, you postulate no further causes. Or you could do the same thing with particles, and you could do the same thing in a variety of ways. And what I find compelling here is whether you take the naturalistic or the theistic realm, both parties are acknowledging a certain fundamental beginning mystery to things, right? Our bias towards the principle of sufficient reason, this bias to expect that everything should be explainable and should have a cause, and that when we get to the point where there is no longer a cause and there is no longer an explanation, we've reached some sort of jarring or unsatisfactory point.
I think this is one of the reasons why theists generally like the theory of the Big Bang, because it implies there was nothing before the act of creation. So Augustine would say something like, well, time, cause and effect were all part of the creation of the universe. So it's meaningless to ask the question, what came before the universe? What was God doing? Waiting to create? No, he wasn't waiting to create the universe because there was no time. There was no cause and effect before the universe was created. And likewise, with the Big Bang, you can draw causes backwards through time in a change until you get to the Big Bang. And it's essentially a singularity, which is meaningless to say, well, what happened before the Big Bang? Because time and consequence was created as a result of the Big Bang expanding or the act of creation of God. So a big overlap here.
Yeah. Even if you are prone to the naturalistic necessary being idea, you're still talking about the limits of explanation, the limits of scientific inquiry, beyond which there is some terrain for purely pragmatic belief in God. So I think this sort of feeds into the Kantian and the William Jamesian idea that even though all these arguments for the existence of God fail, belief in God is not inconsistent with reason and science and so on and so forth. You can't show that God doesn't exist, and you can't even show that it's unreasonable to believe in God.
I think Mackey would probably jump on that.
Mackey would reject that. You know?
Yeah, he would say, okay, well, you've got this uncaused cause, whether it's the Big Bang or a God creating time, but what's to say that there's only one, or what's to say that it's a God the way theists conceive of a God? It could be multiple uncaused causes, which would be a problem for most theists.
Yeah. At this point, we have to be you say you don't know, right?
But he also says, why do we believe that the principle of sufficient reason holds here? Maybe you just get to the point where there is no explanation, and you're just going to have to deal with that fact.
Right, you have to stop somewhere, so why stop at God as opposed to a unified self-subsistent nature
right.
or a fundamental pot of material stuff.
In either case, you're still stopping at a necessary being or beings. You can call them, again, ultimate particles or the universe as a whole. You can say that's the necessary being that has no further explanation, and all explanation occurs within that realm. The very idea of explanation only makes sense within that realm. Mackey's argument is there. Well, we accept the principle of sufficient reason all the way up to this point, and then we cut ourselves off from it.
No, what he's saying is that you can. He's saying we don't, which is why you find yourself in a position where you have to postulate something that explains why. When you get to the last chain, if you're on this regressive, backwards-looking, there was this that caused this, that made this, that made this, that made this, and you get to the point where you can't figure out what that last thing is, this inherent need we have to find a reason for why right. things happen will then make you postulate, well, there must be something that caused this thing. But he says, actually, maybe nothing did cause this. And we don't need to see that as unsatisfactory.
Well, look, our two alternatives are this idea of a self-causing thing, God, which is also a kind of mystery, the idea of self-causing.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of something being causeless is just as mysterious. I don't think we have many good grounds for choosing one over the other. And so what I'm saying is that the common ground here between the naturalist and the theist is more important than the disagreement. Because what they agree on is that you reach some terminus to the explanatory chain, the necessary being, and you can call it God or say, no, it's purely natural.
Or your Spinoza. And
kind of identify the two, yeah.
Right, so that nobody understands what you are.
But in either case, right, the fact that this domain of explanation has come to an end at a certain point, I think makes room for purely pragmatic, in the Jamesian sense, motivations for what you're going to believe. You're not constrained to be an atheist. You're not constrained to be a theist, unless Kant is right about practical reason and blah, blah, blah. But you're not constrained to be an atheist either. For me, that's the more interesting question here. Not whether you can prove the existence of God, but whether it's possible to be a believer reasonably, whether there's just so much evidence for against it that you'd have to be irrational to be a believer.
And I think theologians like this idea of the questions undecided, because it seems like it would be a better relationship with God if it's one of choice rather than one of requiring a massive intellect to figure out that God's actually there. There's a choice to have a relationship or to act on faith, as opposed to being compelled by rational evidence, which then sort of says, okay, well, smart people will figure this out and dumb people won't figure this out. And that's kind of a problem for theology. Essentially, it's a problem with all rational arguments for God, is that it takes away this idea of whether it's having a relationship with God or whether it is an idea of judgment. How could you have a judgment day that is contingent upon someone being able to figure out this Anselm proof or a cosmological proof?
You get an F. To hell with you.
Exactly.
Literally. Yeah.
That's a good point, Robert, and it makes me think of what Mark just said about Spinoza and Wes about naturalistic. It's like part of what you want to accomplish in proving the existence of God is not just proving the existence of something necessary, but proving the existence of something that's worth worshiping or doing whatever it is, the work that God is supposed to do for you. Because I think we want more out of our concept of God than just creation. We can come up with creation on our own, I think, ultimately, as Wes suggested, there's kind of a naturalistic explanation. But that doesn't get you to sacrifice for your sins, morality,
right.
Love. It doesn't get you much of anything.
I mean,
so,
you don't get I should look after the poor and orphans from the cosmological argument.
No.
There's a version of this in Aristotle, who's certainly not, his work was taken up by Thomas Aquinas and lots of religious folks.
Well, the unmoved mover.
Aristotle totally prefigured Christ. What are you talking about?
Should I read a little bit of Thomas Aquinas on this? They're very short. So he has in his Summa Theologica, question to the existence of God, article 3, whether God exists, he says, the existence of God can be proved in 5 ways. 1 through 3 are all versions of the cosmological argument. Number 1 is about movement specifically. If something is moving, something else should have pushed it. Therefore, there must be an original pusher. Well, once you know physics and have the idea of like kinetic and potential energy and things like that, that becomes much less interesting. So that number 2 and 3, I think, are the ones that are still alive and addressed here. The second way is from the nature of the efficient cause. efficient cause being the thing that did the immediate causing, not like the beginning of the universe was the ultimate cause or something, but no, the efficient cause, the one right before it. So from the nature of the efficient cause, in the world of sense, we find that there is an order of efficient causes. There is no case known, neither is it indeed possible, in which a thing is found to be the efficient cause of itself. For so it would be prior to itself, which is impossible. Now, in efficient cause, it is not possible to go on to infinity, because in all efficient causes following in order, the first is the cause of the intermediate cause, and the intermediate is the cause of the ultimate cause, whether the intermediate cause be several or only one. Now, to take away the cause is to take away the effect. Therefore, if there be no first cause among efficient causes, there will be no ultimate nor any intermediate cause. Okay, so let's stop there. So it's kind of like a chain, that what is happening now is hanging on the end of a chain. If the beginning of the chain wasn't there, the whole chain would fall down. You wouldn't have a chain. And I think it's interesting that this same thing is used in Buddhism for exactly the opposite reason. Like, there is nothing underneath. Therefore, the whole thing is illusory. But the way he ends it here, but if in efficient causes it is possible to go on infinity, there will be no first efficient cause, neither will there be an ultimate effect, nor any intermediate efficient causes, all of which is plainly false. Therefore, it is necessary to admit a first efficient cause to which everyone gives the name of God.
Yeah.
There's the question again, the different versions of it. Is this causation in time or outside of time? And this version is like the movement is in time. He says specifically something can't cause itself because then it would have to be temporally prior to itself. Whereas you don't have to, you could even accept, according to one's Mackie considers, that there's an infinite chain of causality. And maybe we have to look at the third way to see why that would be a problem. Should I read that to get it over with?
Sure.
Because everybody wants to hear more Thomas Aquinas. The third way is taking from possibility and necessity and runs thus. We find in nature things that are possible to be and to not be, since they are found to be generated and to corrupt, and consequently they're possible to be and to not be. But it is impossible for these always to exist, for that which is possible not to be at some time is not. Right? Everything is born, everything dies. Therefore, if everything is possible to not be, then at one time there could have been nothing in existence. Now, if this were true, even now there would be nothing in existence, because that which does not exist only begins to exist by something already existing, right? If everything is born and everything dies, then at some point there was nothing. But then nothing would have started in the first place. So this is actually a version of the temporal one as well.
Maybe put another way is that you can't get something from nothing unless there's some force that's not subject to any of the common sense rules of causality that kickstarts the process.
Yeah, I think the a causal way is, if you're more generally thinking about that necessary versus contingent, that somehow all of the fleeting things in the Heraclitean stream name drop, it's just an intellectual necessity that they have to have something basic that they're resting upon, or else they wouldn't exist at all. So there has to be a necessary being. It's harder to understand if you interpret it without thinking of it as this thing was temporally at the beginning. But the way Swinburne thinks of it, not only that God temporally started things off, but he sustains, and you know, he obviously didn't make this up. This is old school Catholic doctrine. God sustains everything that exists from every moment. I mean, it's like you even need an explanation for inertia. Wow, this pencil is here, and now it's still here, and now it's still here. Why is it still there?
Yeah, I think Mackie, though, is relatively sympathetic to the regress argument. And one of the reasons is just on empirical grounds, modern cosmology shows that there isn't an infinite regress, right? The chain of causes is, in fact, finite, which Mackie mentions. But then he's all sympathetic to some of these regress arguments. He doesn't think they're entirely cogent. But I think his main argument is, even accepting that, that the question is what you accept as the termination of the regress. Why is a god who can create something from nothing more acceptable than just what, quote-unquote, sheer origination of things not determined by anything?
Once we're at that point, we can start considering probabilities. The latter part of Mackie's discussion here is on Swinburne's version of this, which is an inductive version. So all these Aristotelian ones and Thomas Aquinas ones are, you know, these are a priori principles. Everything has a cause. We don't know that just because we observe. How would we come up with a generalization just based on we observe that everything has to have a cause? But if we think, well, it's pretty damn likely that everything has a cause, and then we have to evaluate, just like we would scientific hypotheses, is the brute fact, as you say, is that more likely? Does that just seem more reasonable on the face of it than a god, a simple god causing all this stuff?
I don't think you can say either is more reasonable than the other.
Well, it's interesting to see him try.
Yeah.
So he brings in probability theory. We're not going to give this in any detail, of course, but whenever you're judging the probability of something, you sort of have to have already a probability judgment. And like, so if I want to say, I'm trying to figure out whether my wife is cheating on me, well, I look at the evidence, but then I also have to evaluate against the background probability. Like, is she likely, given what I know of her character, likely to cheat on me at all? If I just think she's just not the kind of person that's going to do that, then even if I see some evidence that looks very fishy, it's not going to be very persuasive. But if I have background knowledge that like, oh, she's just freaking crazy, could do anything, it makes any evidence that comes up more likely. And the problem with this, of course, Kantian objection is there are no background probabilities. We have no way of saying a priori whether a god is more likely than the brute fact. Mackie tries anyway, and Swinburne definitely tries by looking at these simplicity constraints. For instance, Swinburne's, the mechanism that he explains it by is mind, right? This pencil continues to exist because God wills it to be so. And Swinburne says, we have so much experience of that. We understand both causation in the physical realm, things bumping each other, and we also understand I will something to happen and then it happens. This talk of intentional causation is just one of the basic explanatory tools we have. In fact, that's the more fundamental one, according to Swinburne, is God intends things. And most of the time, he makes things happen through these long chains of material causation. God caused rational beings to arise through this long process of natural selection. That's all fine. But also, God can just jump in and will something and not use material means to get it done.
That's a way, too, of getting towards an idea of a self-caused causer. Because if God were just another material thing, then we would still be inclined to ask what caused him. Or even if we thought about his mind in empirical psychological terms, well, we'd have to ask what dynamics led God to make a certain decision. So the idea of free will and God's will is a way to say, well, look, here's an appealing end to the chain of causality, because this will is a case where you can get at something that's itself uncaused, but does the causing. That's an argument for saying, no, don't stop at the brute fact, which is unsatisfactory because it's itself uncaused. Let's find something which has the nature of being self-causing, and then you have to go for will. Will is your best candidate for a self-causing cause.
We experience it all the time. We understand freedom of the will, so we can understand to that extent how God chooses to do stuff. Of course, just like our understanding of the infinite, it's a very empty kind of understanding. We still don't know what it's like to be God, but there's something analogous that we can point to.
So there's a place in here where Mackie quotes Swinburne. It's on page 98. There is quite a chance that if there is a God, he will make something of the finitude and complexity of a universe. It is very unlikely that a universe would exist uncaused, but rather more likely that God would exist uncaused. The existence of the universe is strange and puzzling. It can be made comprehensible if we suppose that it is brought about by God. This supposition postulates a simpler beginning of explanation than does the supposition of an uncaused universe, and that is grounds for believing the former supposition to be true. Now, this just strikes me as completely ludicrous. It sounds to me like what you would expect if we found cave drawing philosophy. It makes more sense that thunder is a god. That is, I mean,
thunder has a beard.
No, it doesn't sound so ludicrous to me.
It's so much a projection of like our own view of the world and the way in which we function in it onto a deity that it just, to me, I have no truck. It's like disrespectful.
See, I don't think it's compelling. But I see the rationale behind it, which is, first of all, the uncaused universe isn't such a great circumstance to find oneself in anyway, right? It's sort of a offense to reason. Something came from nothing without any cause. Here it is.
An offense to reason.
Yeah. You don't. Exactly. You find nothing unsettling about the idea of a uncaused, unexplained universe?
No, it does not disquiet me in the least. But that's because I understand that I'm a human being and that there are limitations to what I can comprehend and be expected to understand.
Well, I'm not saying you would expect to find out the answer, but just that evokes one's curiosity.
I don't disagree with that, but it evokes one's curiosity. I mean, for Swinburne, within the confines of the human need to have a causal chain of explanation.
Swinburne's argument is that God is more satisfying because it's a simpler explanation in some sense, it unites all phenomena, and because the notion of mind and will is a more intuitive way of getting at a self-causing thing, which is a more satisfying end of the chain. Even though I don't find it compelling, I still see why that's appealing.
Robert, what do you think?
I think it is appealing. But it's subject to the problem that I think Seth raised, which is humans look for patterns in the data. It doesn't mean that there are patterns. We could say, oh, I look at this, I think the simplest explanation is the best explanation. But that doesn't make it true.
But does it give us a reason to believe it?
There's definitely a reason to believe it. I mean, I don't think it's completely irrational to say, are we here because of God designed the universe the way it is, or it's a uncaused event that's completely random. I choose to believe that it's God, and I have a basis for doing that because I think it's more likely. I don't think that's a completely irrational position. It's subject to the problem that that doesn't necessarily make it true.
But I think you could apply that critique to any argument, right? That's a very general...
Any inductive argument, yeah. Seems like you're still... When you have in mind arguments for any existence of God, you have in mind this model of deductive arguments that compel you. And the whole advance here with Swinburne and Mackey is, well, okay, we're not going to get those, but is there anything left? Can you still have these inductive arguments that are, they're not just, well, we have no idea whether there's a God or not, and so we just have to make a choice or a leap. No, we have reason. There's reason involved. And the reason is not just, you know, a calculation about your internal soul. It's a calculation about the matter at hand.
Yeah, you can imagine that you're at this precipice of there's sort of a particle that is uncaused, which causes the entire creation, or you could take one leap further to God and say that God initiated this particle or singularity which created the universe. Now, the problem that I have is two people can look at that and reach two different conclusions. So yes, it's consistent for one person to say, yeah, God is the more logical explanation and the simplest explanation. But just as easily, another person could say, no, it's not convincing or compelling that God would have to do this. And I don't see how you get beyond that.
Well, let me add one additional thing, which is you could say that if you have a purely mechanistic explanation, then not only is it one particle kicking things off, but it's also the laws of nature themselves. How does the kicking off work? And you have to give some sort of explanation for, say, many, many quarks. Like, why are all those quarks similar? Why do they behave in the same way or something? And Swinburne thinks that it's simpler. Like, who dictates the laws of nature? That is, we can understand the laws of nature better to understand them as the realized intentions of some mind than we can that they're just more and more just brute facts, because you can't reduce all laws of nature to one. Even though if you have one particle kicking things off, so that looks simple, you don't have one law of nature somehow giving birth to everything else. There's always going to be multiplicity that needs to be consolidated somehow in a perfect explanation.
I think the atheist objection, which is a fair objection, is, well, maybe the laws of nature didn't have to unfold the way they have in this universe. And maybe there have been millions, if not billions, of uncaused causes which created universes.
We're talking about universe.
Yeah, okay.
As in
created
everything.
Spaces.
It would be all the
cosmos.
Right.
The multiverse. Yeah.
So if there are multiple universes in the physics sense of universe, then our use of universe would include all of those.
So. Okay, so what is the word for one universe within many? Possible world.
Sure.
Okay, so if we say that there's a possible world or another world that was created, but it didn't have gravity or didn't have cause and effect, well, life would never have advanced to the point where there'd be someone asking the question, how did I get here? So perhaps it has happened over and over and over, but this world is the one where the laws of nature were so aligned that it got to a point where a mind could ask, how did I get here? That implies it's one out of many, many. And I think that's a fair objection.
I think Mackey himself doesn't like that objection, does he? The idea of multiple universes is kind of a controversial thing in physics. It's not a well-accepted...
Yeah, even a hypothetical one, you could see that if you didn't have the laws of nature the way they are here, we wouldn't be here to ask the question. Does that mean that the universe was designed with people in mind to ask the question? No, I don't think so. It just means that I think the question wouldn't come up if we were in a different kind of a universe.
Where does Mackey talk about all that?
It's actually in the argument from design part.
Yeah,
so this you're pointing out a good similarity.
This idea that supposing that there is a God is more satisfactory because it's simpler and all that,
mm-hmm.
You can make that same jump without even going through any of the cosmological work. Somebody who would say, I experience the world as violent and terrible, and I'm constantly enduring hardship and suffering, and it makes me feel better. It is more satisfactory to me to believe that there's a God that's putting me through this for a particular reason. Let's call it an afterlife. And so I choose to believe that there's an order and a reason to my experience on this earth. And that would just be talking about revealed religion. It has nothing to do with cosmology, but it's the exact same move, and it's just as valid.
It's not about what makes me feel better. In this case, it's about what's more likely, what's a more likely inductive generalization based on the evidence.
Use the word satisfactory.
Yeah, but not just satisfactory in like, you know, this feels good, but satisfactory as in satisfying reason.
See our pragmatism discussion.
Yeah, and this does get into pragmatism. At least what Mackey and Swinburne are concerned about here is not whether, at this point, which hypothesis makes you feel better. It's which hypothesis is more likely, inductively, based on the evidence. And I think, for me, I don't find that there's a slam dunk argument to go either way, to say the brute naturalistic facts are more satisfying than the God hypothesis, or vice versa. What you're talking about, Seth, here in terms of subjective satisfaction does become relevant at that point. So for someone like William James, for instance, when you talk about pragmatic concerns, you're not suddenly freed from empiricism and evidence and those sorts of things. But under certain circumstances, you are freed from empirical evidence. So, for instance, in his Will to Believe essay, there is room to say, yes, it's better for me. It feels better to believe, so I believe. But you're only allowed that move after you've accepted that the empirical evidence doesn't go either way. Science leaves you an agnostic. And then at that point, you're left to your own devices to make choices about belief based purely on whether or not it gives your life meaning and or serves your life in some way.
Let me just give Mackey's response to the Swinburne point so we can at least get off that one, which is, you know, while Swinburne finds it intuitively more likely to have a designer, Mackey thinks, actually, the analogy doesn't seem to hold very well, that we don't have any experience of just willing something and it just happens with no mechanism involved. So far from that being having an initial likelihood because it's so simple, that's freaking bizarre. Like, no, everything that happens, happens through some mechanism. So having the ultimate explanation of everything is God just wills it and it is so, is not something we even understand, let alone that we would say is antecedently likely before we're...
Well, the argument there, though, is that the way willing feels to us subjectively is that it feels uncaused. So we understand it in that sense, even though on the empirical level, we know that there's always mechanism.
And that's what you were objecting to, Seth, right? As cave paintings, that like, that's our own ignorance about our own feelings.
Well, yeah, I think in part that's, I have an issue with the anthropomorphization, if you will, of God in all of this.
It is tied in very closely with views of free will. You know, of course, if you're a materialist and think that our decisions, what seem to us as free decisions, are really our brain acting in a mechanistic manner, and you're a reductionist and that experience is somehow not real, of course, then you're not going to accept Swinburne's explanation. But, you know, Hume wasn't that kind of thing, but still thought that we have, just considering motives, not talking about brain states, but just why did I do this? Because I had a motive to do this, that we still interpret our mental acts as not uncaused. There are other variations on that. It turns into a whole different argument about whether this freedom as being completely uncaused.
Yeah, mental acts are always motivated, but they can be motivated by different things. They could be motivated by external causes or motivated by
principles,
things that are internal. And that's where you get the more nuanced idea of free will, where actions are always motivated and there's always some mechanism at work. But it's just a question of where that mechanism is located.
I'd suggest we get to the last main category.
We weren't going to discuss the teleological argument, the argument from design, in as much detail as the others, for one reason, because a lot of Mackey's book here is drawing on Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which I think we're going to do a future episode on at some point. I have in the Swinburne a quote from William Paley, his Natural Theology, 1806. This is the famous one for folks that have not heard this before, about the watch.
Right.
In crossing a heath, suppose I pitched my foot against a stone and were asked how the stone came to be there. I might possibly answer that, for anything I knew to the contrary, it had lain there forever, nor would it perhaps be very easy to show the absurdity of this answer. But suppose I had found a watch upon the ground, and should be inquired how the watch happened to be in that place, I should hardly think of the answer, which I had before given, that for anything I knew the watch might have always been there. Yet why should not this answer serve for the watch as well as for the stone? Why is it not as admissible in the second case as in the first? For this reason, for no other, namely that when we come to inspect the watch, we perceive, what we could not discover in the stone, that its several parts are framed and put together for a purpose. They are so formed in a justice as to produce motion, for instance, and that motion so regulated as to point out the hour of the day, so that if the different parts had been differently shaped from what they are, or different size from what they are, placed in any other manner, in any other order in which they are placed, either no motion at all would have been carried on in the machine, or none would have answered the use that is now served by this. The inference we think is inevitable, that the watch must have had a maker, and that there must have existed at some time, at some place or other, an artificer or artificers who formed it for that purpose, which we find it actually to answer, who comprehended its construction and designed its use. So then the whole rest of his book, Natural Theology, is just explaining how things in nature look to be designed like this. Look how the eye, look how that's constructed. That could never happen by chance. So a lot of this, and Mackey and Swinburne both take a lot of the force of that, is already sapped by evolutionary theory, that we can explain by natural selection how an eye could, even though it seems like it's an inalienably complex organism, you could come up with a natural selection explanation. And we could certainly do a whole episode just on that. And so Dawkins, one of the new atheists, that's like the whole of his deal, is your only good reason for believing in a God is because things look designed. But I can show you here and here and here. I can give a purely mechanistic explanation that shows that there's no designer necessary to give the appearance of design. Therefore, the argument is over. Well, for Mackey and Swinburne, it's not over. Luckily, we've already just talked about this. Yeah. There's still the cosmos as a whole. How did that come into being? And the laws of nature themselves.
Right. So page 140. Here he says, again, after modern developments in cosmology, anyone who wants to use anything like the astronomical variant of the argument must locate the order to be explained in some initial setup, perhaps somewhere inside the Big Bang. But it may be argued that there's still something that calls for further explanation with the various basic materials and physical constants as they contingently are. Life and evolution and consciousness are naturally possible. Things might easily have been different. Is it not remarkable and intrinsically surprising that things happen to be just right for the possibility of these developments? And he goes on to give a relatively sympathetic account to being surprised. But the objection we are considering is different. There is only one actual universe with a unique set of basic materials and physical constants. And it is therefore surprising that the elements of this unique setup are just right for life, and they might easily have been wrong. This is not made less surprising by the fact that if it had not been so, no one would have been here to be surprised.
Right, that's Roberts.
Yeah.
So Mackey is siding with the surprise argument.
He references Darwinism, and he says Darwinism proposes a theory of what we'll call selective order. Evolution by natural selection mimics purposiveness, and so can thoroughly explain this curious adapting. Not only is this an alternative hypothesis to that of design, it is clearly the correct one, whereas that of special creation is false.
Yeah, at this point we've accepted Darwin, right, and now we're saying, well, what about the fact that the laws of the universe and initial conditions were just perfectly right for leading to evolution and consciousness? And in fact, it's a very narrow range of initial conditions that even leads to an ordered universe. Mackey says something which suggested to me that he doesn't understand this, actually, because even Newton in Principia Mathematica goes through and says, the way we describe the movement of the Earth around the sun, for instance, it's according to this inverse square law. And he looks at a lot of different other possible laws and says, well, what would happen if it were an inverse cube law? Well, the Earth would immediately spiral into the sun. What about this? What about that? Or what if it were just a one-to-one proportion? That doesn't work either. Newton was also a theologian, so he has this interest in examining all these different other possibilities and showing that you wouldn't even have a functioning universe. You would never get circular motion. You would never get any of these things which form the basis of regularity and constancy and things persisting in their existence. You simply couldn't get them except based on one very specific set of laws. So that's the argument here, is that there's a very narrow range of laws and principles that would lead to the kind of ordered universe, much less a universe in which natural selection is possible and consciousness and things like that. So that's the updated design argument, where you've accepted Darwin and gone to a different level.
So I see on page 149 here in the Mackey, he gives in this discussion some sort of follow-up, a reiteration of what I had said he had replied to Swinburne's notion about the cosmological argument. He says, contrary to what Swinburne says, the postulate of a divine mind, if given enough content to raise the probability of there being pervasive regularities, right? In other words, the law of nature being all quarks acting the same, all that stuff. In particular, if we assign to this mind the power to create a universe from nothing and to put into it and maintain in it pervasive regularities by unmediated fulfillments of intention, right, through his will alone, is far from simple. The introduction of this category of immediate intention fulfillment is at variance with what we really know about our own intentional actions and conforms only to an illusory, oversimplified, naive understanding of them. For this reason, it is unlikely in the extreme in relation to our background knowledge. Or we can look at the issue more generally. If the theistic hypothesis is not the utterly vague postulate that there exists that which would account for temporal order, the God that it introduces must be something of a specific sort with specific ways of working. If these are in time, then the problem of temporal order has been relocated. If they are outside of time, then we have an even more obscure and antecedently unlikely supposition than that of immediate intention fulfillment. In comparison with these unlikelihoods, the supposition that there simply is a temporal order as an ultimate, not further explainable brute fact is much more probable. So there you go.
That, for me, isn't a slam dunk. Now, I accept the objection, but I could never make a decision between the theistic and the non-theistic based on Swinburne versus Mackey.
Well, Dawkins really runs with that, too, that you can't say that something is responsible for all this complexity and all this stuff, and yet it is itself ultimately simple. That's not how causality works.
But in either case, we're dealing with something that's explanatorily unsatisfactory. Explanation means finding causes, and if you say the causal chain has come to an end, you've reached a explanatorily unsatisfactory end, and then the theistic hypothesis, which tries to circumvent that, has its own problems as well. I don't see how you say either is actually satisfactory. In either case, you've reached this termination of the causal chain, which means the termination of the explanatory chain, which means you'd essentially come to say it's inexplicable. Which hypothesis of inexplicability is preferable?
Exactly, yeah.
Which ultimately just comes down to a choice that satisfies your psychological state, which is the point I was trying to make earlier.
No, I think you're right, yeah. I mean, once you've gotten to that point, yeah.
I just like the fact that now that we've gone through this analysis, that it looks like the force of the teleological argument here goes back to the cosmological argument. Mm-hmm. His last paragraph here on 149, as with the form of the argument based on spatial order, these objections can be avoided only by going back to the supposedly a priori principle that a God is self-explanatory, whereas everything else is in need of further explanation. But to make this move is to revert to the core of the intendedly demonstrative forms of the cosmological argument, whose weaknesses have already been exposed earlier. I conclude the argument for design cannot be revived. So, to really accept the argument from design, you have to accept the cosmological argument. And then we already saw, at least an argument by Kant, that the cosmological argument is reducible to the ontological argument.
Mackey rejects that, right?
He doesn't like that, but there's a connection. The form of the cosmological argument that's talking about a necessary being.
Yeah.
Certainly, we're still using the same words. Maybe part of being a necessary being is not, as the ontological says, to exist necessarily, but it's all sort of packed into the same intuition.
The naturalist doesn't reject the existence of necessary being or beings, right? The naturalist accepts a necessary being because it's the brute naturalistic fact becomes a necessary being.
But it's just not that everyone calls God.
Yeah.
And this we call God.
Yeah. What the necessary being is the necessary being natural or divine?
I had referred back in our Spinoza discussions to Karen Armstrong's The Case for God, which looked to me like, oh, this is somebody who's responding to the new atheists, but she is more in favor of, like Schleiermacher, this apophatic religion, this God is too big to fit in our head. The statements about God are not true or false because they defy human understanding. A mystic, essentially.
Right.
Whereas Swinburne is the opposite of that. And it's like all these are trying to push Swinburne. What you're saying there, Wes, is to try to push Swinburne as well as the atheists into some sort of mysticism. There's always something unexplainable. And we just dwell with that.
Yeah.
And I think that Karen Armstrong kind of view is gaining popularity. So this idea that does God exist? I mean, what does existence mean? God's an object subject to the laws of the universe? Well, no, clearly not. God doesn't exist in that sense. So aren't the atheist and the theist, in a sense, the same? That's kind of this mysterious, mythic conception of God and something not really addressed in Mackey.
Well, he addresses it, but he just has no tolerance for it at all. He's just like, if you're thinking that what I believe is, it cannot be spoken, well, that's because it's incoherent. So stuff like what we were saying with the Schleiermacher, that you should interpret religious doctrines as not actually stating facts. They're just sort of shorthand ways of expressing an attitude. And he doesn't mention Schleiermacher in particular, but he has some other people that he has in mind. It's all just mind tricks on ourselves, Mackey would say. This is no part of philosophy at all.
Well, but I think this is a good sort of point where you get the crossover between rational and irrational systems. So if we go back to the Taoism podcast that was quite a while back, the Tao Te Ching has this notion that the Tao cannot be spoken. You can't put it into words. And essentially, this is a tradition that many people have. And it's unclear whether you can actually rationally think about. Can you subject these things to empirical tests? Not really.
It needs to be experienced, not reasoned to.
Exactly. And I think also the concept of putting things into words is inherently limiting. I think the Taoist or the person who believes God is bigger than existence or bigger than reason, that the moment that you start to use words to describe it, you're by definition limiting God.
In that sense, then you would say that that activity is not philosophical.
Correct. It's not a philosophical, rational inquiry, which maybe is why Mackie has so much contempt for it.
I remember in one of the New Atheists, I don't actually remember which one it was, that some of these apophatic systems that are described, the author was saying, like, I don't even know where I fall on this because you're not clear enough about what doctrine you're putting forward. Maybe I'm a theist according to this weird abstract doctrine of theism that cannot say anything about God because you haven't given me anything to actually evaluate.
Well, yeah, that's exactly it. You get the idea of someone who doesn't believe in God, but practices this religion, but isn't making a definitive claim that there is no God. They're not saying that there is a God. It's beyond. It's full of those Buddhist one hand clapping, that kind of thing. Yeah, you could say it's ridiculous, or you could say it's just, it doesn't lend itself to a rational discussion about it. Things just are, they're unknowable. I'm not sure what there is to say about it if you're trying to take a logical approach to it.
All right, so given that, and we made Robert read this whole book, right?
I did.
So there's a giant section, like 50 pages on the problem of evil. It's like a 300-page book. And we didn't know exactly which parts to attack. So we said, Robert, we're not going to do this for a couple months. You read it first. And you actually did. So I'm very impressed by that. Do you feel, after that experience, even though you started with this, it's a choice of faith, rational argumentation has no place, and now it sounds like you're ending in that same spot, has this experience of getting through this whole book, has it improved your understanding in some way? Or is it just a fun academic exercise?
No, I think it has improved my understanding. I do feel like I am back where I began, which is that I'm not convinced that you can reason your way to God. But I think going through the exercises of what are the critiques of arguments for God, I think was certainly an exercise in building mental strength. It's been a while since I got to Descartes. But the problem that I had was I feel like there was a bit of a straw man argument set up, which is that we'll assume that theism is XYZ and that everyone who believes it has rational arguments for it, and then we're going to attack those rational arguments, therefore atheism is the most logical conclusion. And that's, I think, something that is missing in this discussion. By analogy, It's a bit like saying I'm going to attack the whole tradition of Christmas by proving that Santa Claus doesn't exist. People experience Christmas, they get excited about it, they engage in it. And someone coming along and saying, well, actually, there's no Santa Claus, and gives us definitive proof of why Santa Claus can't possibly deliver all the presents on Christmas Eve.
Forgot the spoiler alert. Sorry.
Sorry, spoiler alert if there are any 6-year-olds listening to the show. But it essentially misses the point of Christmas. Christmas is not about a literal belief in Santa Claus. And I think for many people, religion is the same, that they live religion as a way of life. And in that experience, they go through phases of believing in God, not believing in God, thinking the question's irrelevant, becoming skeptics on it, not becoming skeptics on it. But religion serves a different purpose. And I think this is touched on a little in chapter 11, Belief Without Reason, but I don't think it's given a proper weight.
Yeah, I think what we're doing here is more religious metaphysics. I mean, I know Mackie is trying to address the question of whether or not it's rational to believe in God, but that's really not the largest part of his enterprise. When I say rationally believe in God, I mean, the question is whether belief in God is consistent with being a naturalist or being reasonable in general, whether or not the evidence is simply so slam dunk against God, it's silly to, you know, the question is whether it's silly to believe in God, I think. One of the big debates in epistemology of religion surrounds evidentialism. And the question of what counts as evidence for God or evidence against. If the evidence is overwhelming against the existence of a God, I think that is a problem for belief, no matter how wedded you are to the concept of faith. But if all the evidence goes against your faith, I think there's a real problem.
Right.
Any other closing thoughts?
So I would echo what Robert said, is that it's not clear that if you go down this path and you say, all right, I can't find any rational argument for the existence of God, therefore, my response to that is to not believe in God. The one thing doesn't follow from the other. You could say, if I have no way of rationally getting an argument for the existence of God, then it's possible that there is another way of acquiring the knowledge or the belief in the existence of God that isn't through reason. That's the possibility that people who want to argue against being theistic don't want to accept, because there's not as much room for debate there. But I also think that this is something that seems to be a not unique, but it certainly seems to be much more sort of Western and much more Christian. You don't see as many attempts, or at least there weren't as many famous attempts to go through a rational proof for the existence of God in, say, Buddhism, Hinduism, Shinto. He mentions in the book, Mackie does, about there are some Islamic proofs for the existence of God that inspired some of the medievals. But it does, to me, seem to be something that's of a concern to, I'll be charitable and say, monotheistic religions, but also specifically Christianity. And we've talked about this before in other podcasts about this kind of my characterization of philosophy as fetishizing the truth and absolutes, that this seems to me yet another endeavor. And it makes me think about whether the subject matter is appropriate for the methodology. For example, should we apply scientific method to sociology or anthropology or psychology or economics for that matter? Is economics a science? And so the question of the existence of God, is that a suitable subject for rational philosophical approach? If we say ironically that the answer is no, it's curious that there are so many of these Western analytic philosophers going after it. And I find that that's just kind of interesting. But I would not base my decision on the belief in the existence of God on anything like any of the approaches that we have taken.
I'd completely agree with you.
But it's fun.
Yeah. Maybe I'm just feeling the pragmatist gushiness or something, but it seems like we tend to try to find reasons for believing things, right? I don't know if I buy this. And I know this hasn't been about faith, and we need to talk about this more in some other episode or something. But I do believe that belief is not something that we choose. That even if in the face of uncertainty, it's not a matter of, oh, we just freely choose among things that I have no rational reason to decide either way. I mean, we could be arbitrary about it, or we could really want one thing over another to be true. But I'm of Mackie's opinion that we're always relying on some sort of reasons. And of course, they're not very well thought out most of the time. And what I really liked about the Mackie book is the details, is that he would look at some of these arguments that,
yeah,
you know, have gone back and forth and back and forth. And he's so very acute, I think, in lots of places, and really, like, I don't know which to decide. You know, again, like I pose some of these things, that just seems reasonable to me, and something else seems reasonable to you. He can kind of cut through and find something to grab onto, yet another reason why you would take one of these rather than the other. So As Kant says, our reason is trying to constantly push itself forward and find reasons for believing everything. So, you know, find some definitive pointer so it's not just a matter of arbitrary or free choice which of these ways we're going to take. It seems like to me kind of a continuum between the speculative reason and practical reason. It's not a sharp distinction that now I'm done considering whether the evidence that I have for whether there's a God or not. So now I'll look inward and decide, since I don't have enough evidence, which way do I want to fall? Or it's very vague to those who are making the decisions themselves, I think.
Yeah.
I think maybe just a touch on Kierkegaard here is this idea, the primacy of commitment, that it requires this infinite interest in the question of does God exist to actually get to God. It's not a question of reasoning your way. So maybe an analogy might be two people can discuss love in a room, but until you actually love someone, you don't get anywhere near at what love is. And Kierkegaard's point would be that you can't have a rational discussion from a priori principles and get to the truth of God, that it actually requires sort of being pushed to a point where you are actually willing to engage. And that's something that's not addressed.
Well, it's addressed, but it's dismissed exactly. Summarily.
Not addressed fairly.
Sympathetic to Kierkegaard at all, yeah.
I think, as Mark mentioned, though, these two paths can be intimately related. So going through reasons for and against the existence of God can be purgative, and can make room, to use the Kantian idea, they can make room for faith. So I think theology and looking at this stuff rationally can actually play an important part in whether or not, you know, not many people are going to do it, but it can play an important part in faith. And going through the arguments and coming out sort of at the rational level and agnostic, but then saying, well, now prudential concerns take over because purely rational evidence leaves me undecided either way, and I'm entitled to make a purely prudential decision. That's one important relationship. For me, if I thought there were overwhelming evidence against belief in God or for atheism, then I would be an atheist. I couldn't go from that to, oh, faith overrides that. That wouldn't work for me. And likewise, if I thought there were overwhelming evidence for God, I would be religious. But as it is, I'm not convinced that there's a slam dunk evidence either way.
I think what's gained from an exercise like this is to rid yourself of poor reasoning. You know, like I think the argument for design is one that people can often fall into. So they would say, oh, look at this. I'm not choosing to believe in God because I want to. It makes sense. And I think at first glance, when someone presents the watch scenario to you and says, you know, hey, here's a watch, you wouldn't think it was a random event. It's quite appealing, but you've got to go through the exercise and see the flaws in the argument. And I think it makes for having more integrity and essentially a stronger mind to go through these exercises, even though there is a sense in which you're not going to reach ultimate knowledge. That's okay.
Well, Robert, I know that you wanted to talk about the moral argument that we didn't get to, although we've touched on that in our Kant episodes, and some other approaches you find in the existentialist tradition or wherever that might be more fruitful than some of the ones we've spent hours dwelling on here. So I'm hoping I can convince you to do a blog post or two to help fill in our readers.
Sure.
So folks can go to partiallyexaminedlife.com. Look for that. Look for other things that we'll post it as follow-up. Next time, Dylan will be back with us, and we will talk about The New Atheist. So if you want to read along with us, read the first two chapters of Sam Harris's The End of Faith, the last three chapters of Christopher Hitchens's God is Not Great, chapter 4, primarily from Richard Dawkins' The God Delusion. Chapter 3 is where he actually goes through these same arguments, and just by way of contrast to Mackie, how not careful he is might be amusing to you. And then chapter 8 is the meat of Dan Dennett's Breaking the Spell. So thanks, everybody, and good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Lord, I believe in subtlety, in stating things with strict exactitude, and attention to the nuance of how dumb I feel. For instance, don't say, ouch. Say, I perceive a tension in my left chest there, and its proximate cause was when you rip the hair out, leaving me lopsided and mildly less bushy and spiritually gushy. Cause I'm not sure why you did it, though I could list 300 reasons. Here goes number one. No, I believe in subtlety. I believe in sounding off at nothing when it really didn't matter what exactly got me going in the first place. I believe in a few basic truths, none of which I could possibly do justice to now. Lord, I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe. Lord, I believe in long, hard work, as long as it's obsessive and completely self-invented and welcome. Like stalking George Burns or writing songs, I believe in bullshit. If bullshit is funny, which it is, I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe. Lord, I believe, Lord, I believe, I believe. I believe if you hate enough and you vent enough, then everyone you meet will just adore you. I believe if I'm loud enough and I'm hoarse enough and I'm foul enough, then I will win.